Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Hello, friends. Father Frank Pavone here, National Director of Priests for Life. Welcome to our program, where once again, we're going to explore one of the Friend of the Court briefs that has been submitted to the United States Supreme Court in this current abortion case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. This is one of the most important abortion decisions that the court has dealt with in decades. There's going to be oral arguments the 1st of December, and then a ruling sometime in 2022, probably in June. And before the court, as we have been explaining, is a relatively simple question. If a state protects babies in the womb before viability, is that automatically unconstitutional? And this is the question that the court is examining. We are taking in these various episodes the different briefs that have been submitted and looking at the arguments that various organizations and leaders in the pro-life movement are presenting in defense of the stance of the state of Mississippi that did pass a law saying babies in the womb should be protected from 15 weeks forward. So now today we're going to talk with a longtime friend and colleague in the pro-life movement who heads up and founded the Good Counsel Maternity Homes based in New Jersey and New York. Chris Bell and I were working together even before Priests for Life was in existence, when I was a parish priest in New York City. So, Chris, welcome to the program. It's great to have you here. Good Counsel Homes submitted one of these briefs to the Supreme Court, which I have here in my hand. And it was prepared by our other guest today, the attorney who has helped Good Counsel Homes to take this step in support of the state of Mississippi. And he is Sean Collier of Collier Legal. Sean, it's great to have you with us as well.
Same here. Thank you, Father.
All right. So we want to talk about the argument that you are presenting to the court. And I think it's a very powerful one, but of course it requires some context. So I'm going to briefly summarize it. And then Sean, I'd like you to, enrich our audience's understanding of the legal dimensions of this. And as we talk about it, Chris, of course, you'll be able to tell us from the point of view of Good Counsel Homes, how your long experience in helping moms and their babies and their families is at this moment speaking into the court. Basically, the situation we're dealing with is this, that in 1992, the Supreme Court had a case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that many thought would reverse or overrule Roe versus Wade, but it did not. And what that decision said was, well, we've got to keep abortion legal. We've got to keep Roe versus Wade in place, because even if we were wrong when we initially decided that case, you know what? Women need abortion. They need it in order to take their rightful place in society. They've come to rely on it. They've come to shape their lives around the idea that abortion would be available. So this is what's called in technical terms the reliance interest in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Good Counsel now is coming along saying to the Supreme Court, that in itself was wrong. To say that women need abortion to take their rightful place in society, hey, look at the experience of Good Counsel Homes. We can tell you differently. You don't have to say, you shouldn't be saying to America, we've got to have abortion so that women can take their equal place. They've relied on abortion. And you dispute and refute that idea. Is that in a nutshell what your brief is saying? And if so, Sean, give us a little bit more of the legal background of that.
Sure. That's an excellent summary, Father. To take a sort of a step back, Roe in my opinion, my humble opinion, and I wasn't around at the time, but Roe accomplished what it did for a reason. It's that the folks in power wanted it to be so. So they were going to get there however they could get there. So from 1973 to 1992, when Casey was decided, you had this decision on the record that was just considered the law of the land. Never mind what all the other states decided. Never mind that every state, I think it was every state, had a prohibitions on abortion on the books. That all went out the window with Roe. And so they had to come up with a justification for it. So they came up with the trimester framework. They came up with the emanations coming from penumbras we're all familiar with. And for many years, that was just the way things were. But that did not protect the Roe decision from scrutiny. And, you know, spoiler alert, everybody today, even people who are defenders of the abortion, the right to, you know, unrestricted abortion, generally admit that Roe was not well decided. It was a poorly decided case. It's, you know, constitutional law with quotes around it. And so when 1992 came along, you know, they had to shore it up a bit. And Casey itself wasn't even an official decision of the court. The Casey court reached whatever decision it did by a vote of the justices, but the prevailing opinion is just what's called a plurality opinion, which means it wasn't five justices or more out of the nine joining onto the opinion. It was actually, I believe, only four of them. And that just became to be the opinion of the court that was, you know, that has been relied on for the law ever since, for the justification for preserving the abortion regime. Now, Father, you did a very good job of explaining this reliance interest. That's just one of the many different justifications that Casey had for upholding what I think they called the central framework of Roe. So they more or less admitted that, okay, Roe maybe wasn't, you know, our best, most shining moment. In fact, Hadley Arkus, you know, Professor Hadley Arkus has a story that, you know, there was a dinner party after Roe, and I won't give it away because he tells it very well. I don't remember all the details anyway, but one of the indications was the justices who decided the Roe case hadn't even read all of the briefs. You know, like someone reacted to something someone said at a dinner party, and he said, "Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that." And the other guy said, "Well, it's in the brief. Didn't you read the brief?" So, you know, they were going to get there however they were going to get there. So Casey comes along, and they shore it up with this, well, this reliance interest among a number of others. And what I found probably most heartening about participating in this experience, which it was my great honor to participate in because Chris came to me, and we'll get back to that, but I don't have any, you know, pro-life bona fides that, you know, a mile long that say, hey, throw this guy in front of the court, everyone's going to listen to him. You know, I'm a decent lawyer, I'm a good writer, I know the arguments, and I thought this was how we could help, and so I did. But it's an incredible honor to have been given the opportunity to participate. But one of the things that was probably the most heartening thing to me was joining a conference call among a number of people who were planning on writing amicus briefs and talking about what can we offer? What can we offer the court? And the people who were sort of coordinating came up with this list of different ideas. And there was, I mean, there were 20, 30 different particular concepts that all needed to be dealt with in some way or another. And the petitioners couldn't, if they had 1,000 pages, they couldn't deal with every one of them, fully and comprehensively. And that's where amici really can serve the court. So they started talking about who can address this, who can address that. And I'm looking down the list and I saw basically what ended up being the final product, which is, do women really need abortion? Was Casey right? Was, even if it wasn't right at the time, is it right now? And that is just exactly on point with the experience of good counsel. And Chris in particular has been doing it for decades now. You know, he's on the front lines every day. He's met scores upon scores of women and been able to conclude firsthand, no, we do not rely on abortion. In fact, it's the opposite. So I'll take a breath there, but that's...
Yeah, it's the opposite. And so, Chris, the experience of Good Counsel, Holmes, and the work that you do really has a message for the courts today. Bring our audience, especially those that may be joining us who don't know about Good Counsel, bring them up to speed about what you do and, again, how that now speaks into this whole argument.
Well, Good Counsel began in 1985, and... I was certainly much younger at the time, with the help of a lot of good people, women and men, and volunteers and paid staff and supporters of all types. The idea was to help a woman who was pregnant and with a child and no place to go. And it was, as it's described in the brief, the first mom, and we call her Anna, who came in and really had no other place to go, but she had a baby. And when she talks about her experience of how she was told to have an abortion and how it left her because she had an abortion, and she then got pregnant within 2 years after that and would not do that again. And when she was telling me this in 1985, I was taken aback. I certainly wasn't pro-abortion, but it was the first time I could think that abortion specifically hurt women. And she wasn't the first one. The second woman who came in had the same experience. The third woman didn't want an abortion, didn't know where to turn. I mean, Good Counsel was young then. There were only a few maternity homes that I was aware of around us in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Well, now, you know, almost 40 years later, we're talking about thousands of women who have called our national helpline, who have come to us from goodcounselhomes.org, emailing for help. Around, we have a list on our website, the 235 maternity homes we are aware of and we can help refer women to. There is no place in America where a woman who is pregnant and needs help cannot go and get that help. But let me describe more specifically why this brief, and it's not the first time we put in an amicus brief, but at this point for this question, what we're answering is, for the women we deal with, they're generally, if they're not economically poor, their family is broken up. I mean, seriously, no mother, no father, no place to turn. Can you imagine being pregnant and not having any relative in the world who will help you? So yes, some of our women are immigrants. Some of our women have mental health problems, drug addiction problems. They have burned all their bridges. So we are dealing with the most difficult pregnancy-related cases. And I can tell you, and you could read in the very simple brief, the few stories we put in of the many thousands we could have, that yes, we can help women through that tragedy, through their own difficulties, and they can go on to be happier, to be healthier, and to lead a, what other people would say measurably is a productive life. Now, I would also say, even if a woman didn't turn out more productive, we can help her do the right thing and her baby will have a better chance in this life because of the interventions of many, many pro-life people like Good Counsel Homes. And now, if you look at women who have a college education, have a family, have other support, to say that abortion is their only answer, that's just not right. It's not true. So how can anybody say that abortion, you can rely on abortion? It's just not, it's like saying we have to rely on slavery to keep the economy going so that, you know, the country won't fall apart. It's not true.
And excellent summary. Brothers and sisters, those of you that are just joining us, we're talking with Chris Bell of Good Counsel Homes, providing alternatives to abortion, providing places for people to stay, to have their babies and to get readjusted to a fruitful and productive life. And we're joined by Sean Collier, also an attorney who has helped Good Counsel Homes to prepare this brief to the United States Supreme Court as it reconsiders Roe v. Wade in this Dobbs case. Gentlemen, it's a short brief, but it doesn't need to be any longer than it is, because the argument, as we've summarized here, is very concise and clear. You don't need abortion. Stop saying that women have to rely on it. Sean, let's go back a little bit to Roe v. Wade itself, because while Casey articulated this reliance clause and they said, oh, women have come to, you know, build their lives around the availability of abortion, we're saying that's contrary to fact. But in Roe v. Wade, it was also making statements that one might say are even more obsolete today than they were then, because it was talking about the stigma of, you know, having being pregnant outside of wedlock. It was talking about, oh, you know, the pregnancy can cause so many kinds of so much psychological damage and whatnot. Sean, there are many briefs, and some of the other briefs, by the way, reinforce directly these kinds of arguments that you're making. Isn't it true to say that what the court's being told right now, today, in the Dobbs case, is, hey, gentlemen, madam justices and gentlemen justices, things have changed. Things have changed radically since Roe v. Wade. The stigma has gone down. They can pursue job and education opportunities online that they couldn't do before. They can... they're protected by all kinds of anti-discrimination laws. There are safe haven laws now where babies can be dropped off at a police station or a firehouse. And not to mention the maternity homes, like Good Counsel, and the pregnancy centers have just mushroomed to a point that it wasn't even on the map when Roe was decided. Does this have an impact constitutionally? In other words, just saying things have really changed since Roe, tell us how that is a powerful argument for the court.
You know, it's funny because in a sense it shouldn't be, because when you're talking about the role that the Supreme Court plays in our constitutional republic, the Supreme Court really shouldn't be looking into all of these things with the weight that it does. I'm not saying it should ignore them, but one of the things when I was saying earlier about Roe not being exactly constitutional law, you've got these justices kind of looking at the landscape and almost saying, well, should we have abortion or shouldn't we? That, why should that be up to these people? You know what I mean? Like, that's not their... How is it an interpretation of the Constitution and the history of our republic and Anglo-American law to say that, well, back then there weren't enough crisis pregnancy centers, but now there are enough. And therefore we think, okay, we can get rid of this abortion thing. It's very silly. Abortion almost more than any other issue casts into light the outsized importance that the court has, you know, arrogated unto itself. Because of cases like this, everyone's watching. Well, what are we going to do? Are we going to declare it okay? Are we going to declare it not okay? So that's the kind of irks me more than anything else, you know, about the role that the court plays in our lives. But all that being said, absolutely right. Your example of the number of crisis pregnancy centers is something that was covered specifically in what I kind of like to think of as a companion brief from Heartbeats International, where they're talking about, hey, anywhere you go, you're going to be able to find help, right? And once you're there, if you can't find help, heck, you'll get a ticket to New York and Chris will take care of you, right? I mean, there are options. You're not alone. But going back to, you know, sort of what I started with, it's like they were going to get to the result they're going to get to anyway. That's a little less true, I think, than it was then. I do have to give the newer justices respect. On both sides, you know, they're the top of, you know, the smartest people that we've had in the profession in you know, a couple hundred years. You have to be that qualified to be a justice on the court. So, you know, I don't mean to drag them down at all, but it's just the role that the court plays has become so confused. We could go on for hours about this, but. The landscape certainly has changed. The landscape certainly has changed. I remember when I was researching what exactly it was that Casey had said on this point, I went into, on the point that we address, I mean, this reliance point, I went into, you know, the footnote and I found that it was exactly one source. It was a book that was written by someone about, you know, like where reproductive rights fit into. I was expecting a 30 citation footnote full of here's surveys about women relying on abortion and they can't go find crisis pregnancy centers, or if they do, they're bound to lose their home and their apartment, and this is the percentage that fall into minority categories, and this is none of that. It was one cite to one book. I was able to get the copy of the book electronically from, I think it was University of Pennsylvania. I read into it. It wasn't that much more enlightening. I said, we're not going to talk about this. This isn't even helpful. So what is helpful, exactly what your father started with, It's what does the landscape look like today? All of these briefs are trying to paint a picture beyond just the constitutional law, saying that Roe is a relic, right? Casey's a, we do things differently now. And, you know, it's not even going to outlaw abortion. Everyone's afraid that, oh, everyone's getting rid of abortion by going to the Supreme Court and getting them to cancel it. It's not what's going to happen. They're going to send it back to the states where you can take these arguments that are made in the amici briefs and you can present them to the people who are supposed to be making decisions, which is you and I, right? And our brothers and sisters, our wives, our daughters, our parishioners, that's who should be making these decisions. So these briefs really should be, and to an extent are, directed at them.
Exactly, yes. And that's something that, of course, these briefs are asking the court to do. I was having another interview recently about the brief that was submitted by hundreds of members of Congress. And these legislators said to the court very succinctly, turn the job of making laws back to the lawmakers rather than to the court, which is another way of saying what you just said. One more point that I'd like to have both of you explain. It's mentioned in the final part of the Good Counsel brief. Not only do women not need abortion to take their rightful place in society, but having an abortion actually hinders them from doing so. And you both made a brief reference to this already. We certainly see it in our work with women who've had abortions through Rachel's Vineyard and the Silent No More campaign. But talk to us about that from the perspective of Good Counsel.
Well, let me say that because Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, you know, is called the law of the land, and because in certain states that have already passed these abortion legislation, which means you can have an abortion up until birth, which really translates into if the baby is born alive, which happens maybe a dozen times a year after an abortion, you don't have to resuscitate, you don't have to treat, you let the baby die or you kill it, which most people would call infanticide. But yes, because of that cultural pressure, and I see it in New York, which is the abortion capital of the world, and New Jersey most specifically, what happens is to like a girl like Carmela, who was told by the doctor the baby she's carrying has a defect, right? Maybe he's, the way he described it, the way she described it to me, it was a defect in every single cell in his body. So she couldn't be more accurate than that. I think it was trisomy 18. Yes, we've had mothers with trisomy 18. I could talk about that. But because there was this pressure on this young woman who did not have a high school education, she naturally responded with, I don't want to do that. And I want to help my baby as long as I can. And I don't care if my baby dies at birth. I want to be a good mother. Now, that was her words to me. And I thought that was so much more intelligent and intuitive and just deeply profound that even the doctor couldn't articulate and her social worker wouldn't help her with. So she came to our home, and because she wanted to pray, I mean, most of our women do want to pray. We don't force them to pray, but we pray with them if they do. And we helped her go back to school, which is what she wanted to do while she was pregnant. And we hoped that, you know, everything would turn out better. Well, when her son was born, the fears of the doctor were unfounded. Her son had a little hole in his heart, a little hole that required two surgeries, which are not uncommon in the United States today. We have the most advanced medical technology in history. So, of course, they could take care of this little boy's heart. And by the time he was 1 year old, because moms can stay at a Good Counsel home for a year or longer, and he was in our daycare, which we offer for free for the moms who are going out to school or working. He was running around and you couldn't even barely see the scar where he had those heart surgeries. And here this doctor said, get rid of him. And this mother now is so happy and just she's renewed and she's hopeful. And we all, I can't say it was a miracle that happened, but I certainly can say that God blessed her and we all felt blessed that, yeah, he's as healthy as he is. And for the moms, we have two moms right now who are dealing with trisomy 18 babies. They love their babies. Don't yes. get anybody wrong. They want to do as much as is possible. And again, they're getting great medical treatment. It looks like both of these little girls are going to live and be as healthy as anyone can. I found out something new this past week, which I didn't know before, and that is trisomy 18. Sometimes it does affect every single cell in the body. Sometimes it's fatal at birth because it's particularly attacking the heart and lungs and the brain. But other times it attacks other cells, and maybe that little child can actually walk and even talk, and like Down syndrome, may have a very simple life, but a very loving life. And for the moms and dads who love their children, let us love them with them. Let us love them enough to help them. Let's not destroy their life or destroy who they are as women, as fathers, as parents who want to have a chance to support them. So because we have this abortion culture, there's this pressure, this unending pressure, particularly on poor women, I have to say, because these are the women I see, a lot of pressure. Why can't we love them more than that and give them an opportunity to really have a full life like they want to? And I can go on and on. I really have so many wonderful opportunities that I've seen of women. And even though they're struggling with a smile on their face and love in their heart. They're a great witness to me. I'm blessed to be able to have a home, good counsel homes, to be able to be part of their lives and walk with them during some of their difficulties and their traumas.
It is a blessing, and thank you for letting me see it right up close firsthand various times over these years that we've worked together. And Sean, your thoughts?
You know, it's funny. I was debating whether or not to mention this, but Chris called her Carmella because Chris has names that, you know, for the women who don't want to be identified or just to protect them, Chris often has, you know, a different name, not the mother's real name. And I exercised a little bit of editorial, license. I actually named her Joan in the brief. And Joan, of course, is Chris's wife, who is an hero of the movement going back these many decades. So, but actually every name in the brief is a little, I handpicked. So Joan is his wife. Kelly is my wife. Rosemary is my daughter. And then Anna is our lady's mother, and Maria is our lady. So I thought it would be a good way to kind of sneak in, you know, who this is really all about. And our lady gets the last word. She's the last story in the brief. So I was hoping that would be a little extra blessing, you know, on the effort we're doing here.
Wow, that's an insight into the brief that we wouldn't get if we weren't talking with you. So that's great. Well, thank you both for the work of Good Counsel and for the work of this brief. We are in this series of programs urging our audience to read these briefs. And friends, this one is only 9 pages long. So don't be afraid of these briefs. Don't think of them as, legal, intimidating legal documents. They're beautiful stories. They're filled with hope. They're filled with conviction that you can also pass on to others. So SupremeCourtVictory.com is our special website dealing with this Dobbs case and having links on it to all the briefs, including this one from Good Counsel Homes. Please go there, read the briefs, watch these videos, and participate in the prayer campaign. You'll find the prayer there for victory in this case, and you can pray it every day as we encourage you to do. So, Chris Bell, founder, president of Good Counsel Homes, thanks very much. And Sean Collier, thank you for your legal work, and blessings on both of you. And we hope to be talking with you again very soon. And thank you all, brothers and sisters, for watching these episodes. Know of our prayers for you here at Priests for Life. Pray for us too, and stay connected online. Once again, SupremeCourtVictory.com. I'm Father Frank Pavone, Director of Priests for Life. Thanks for joining us today.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.